Welcome back from the tea break. We shall continue with the program. During the break, the thought struck me is something that constantly comes across our work in the South African Institute of International Affairs. And that's when one deals with complicated political struggles. It's always interesting to see the extent to which it calls on actors to move beyond ourselves. We have to sometimes compromise, sometimes we have to constantly move beyond what we think we are capable of. So with that, the program also comes to the official position on the situation. And I will firstly call on His Excellency Ali Halime, the Ambassador of Palestine to South Africa, a well-known person in the South African community. And we welcome you to share your thoughts with us. And just a quick important comment that Zaki Ahmed would like to retract the statement he made.
Sorry, can I retract it?
Yes, you can. More than welcome to do that.
Chair, I'm thankful that you reminded me, Mr. Sasana. I think, if I may, retract my comment, and that's it.
Thank you.
Now that's reconciliation in practice.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the Portfolio Committee for International Relations and Cooperation, members of Parliament, distinguished friends and colleagues. First of all, I would like to extend my sincere thanks and appreciation for the chairman of the committee for having given me once again an opportunity to come and join all of you to discuss issues of mutual concern regarding the developments in the Middle East. As earlier speaker said, in South Africa, the Middle East issue is an important issue which is being always discussed and debated. And I know it involves a lot of political, emotional dimension. But indeed, for us Palestinians, South Africa is an important country, and we highly appreciate this government's role in promoting political stability and peace. Some people may not like the word peace in the region. Therefore, I'm here on the invitation of my brother, Mr. Magama, to talk about the Palestinian bid to join the United Nations. And as you all aware, that the Palestinians of the Palestinian leadership, supported by the Palestinian people, have decided to take the issue of Palestine and take our status to the heart of the world community, to the heart of the United Nations. And it is, ladies and gentlemen, very important that the Palestinians join other nations and play a role in order to promote political development. And it's a natural right and historical right for the Palestinians to apply to become full member of the United Nations. Previous United Nations resolutions have given us this right. The 181 resolution, which was adopted 63 years back, gave the Palestinians a right of a state of their own. Possibly it took us some time to implement this right. There were certain circumstances and reasons for this delay, but I see no reason why the Israelis find it difficult to accept Palestine to become a member of the United Nations. The UNESCO model is a clear evidence that the world do support the Palestinians to join the United Nations. I know the Israelis and certain powers try to prevent us from applying for the UNESCO, but our determination, our conviction and devotion for peace, political stability, and the right of the Palestinian people self-determination and to choose ourselves for ourselves, giving us that hope and the support of the international community. If Israel is a member of the United Nations, why not the Palestinians? Yes, people may argue, you know, you don't have the land. The land is there, very much there. Unfortunately, it's occupied by Israel. The people are there, and it's a sovereign decision of any nation on this world to choose for themselves. And if they have the support of the world, why not? 107 countries supported Palestine's admission to the UNESCO. I'm sure we will have more number of those states who will support us if we go to the United Nations. Yes, certain powers they have the right of veto, but that's not the end of this world. If the United States decides for any reason to veto the Palestinian bid, that's not the end of the world. We are going to continue and try and try and try until we join this organization. The United States veto will not deter the Palestinians from their efforts to continue to join the United Nations. And the USA and the administration knows this fact. They have been entertaining Israel so long. But it didn't help peace. So our bid is a legitimate exercise which we are implementing. It is good for Israel to see the Palestinians having equal footing, an equal membership of the United Nations. If they consider us partners in this political exercise in the Middle East, I see no reason why they reject our bid. And why they are making so many problems and difficulties and causing noise every day about it. Someone is saying, no, why? If it is no, why are you making such noise and mobilizing the international community against? And our struggle has been having different dimensions and different forms, This is a pure political and diplomatic exercise which we have been implementing or involved ourselves with. They talk about negotiations. Who is not negotiating. How can we negotiate and talk about an independent Palestinian state when Israel continues to confiscate and grab land and build Jewish settlements in the heart of the Palestinian land? What peace are we talking about there? What state are we going to talk about? Mr. Netanyahu and his government talks about an independent Palestinian state, which he himself say it should be demilitarized, should not have any capacity to defend itself. He will control the skies. Whoever is coming to visit a future Palestinian state, having a private charter plane coming into our, one of our airports, Tel Aviv, has to give him the permission. What state are they talking about then? Peace requires that the Israelis stop building settlements. Building a future independent state requires from Israel to be more transparent. You cannot take the land and build and bring more Jewish settlers into the heart of the Palestinian land and talk about state. It's not possible. Distinguished guests, members of the committee, the Palestinians have a legitimate right to establish full independent state. We have already accepted that two states will live side by side. Many Palestinians today support the Palestinian leadership towards establishing permanent peace in the Middle East, in particular vis-à-vis Israel. Israeli government daily are undermining the Palestinian leadership. Abu Mazen, the man who initiated the Oslo Agreement, the man who negotiated from day one with Israel, pre-1993, Lieberman talking about him that he should disappear. He should leave. He is the only obstacle. Now they are preparing for something for him. That reminded me of late Chairman Arafat, when some of the Israeli leadership started talking about Arafat being an obstacle facing the peace process in the Middle East. My worry that the Israelis may target my president, a man who devoted all his life to achieve permanent political settlement in the country, based on justice. Somebody spoke about justice. Yes, indeed, we need justice, and justice for everybody. Where is Israel from the several United Nations resolutions? It's the only country in this world which was created by UN resolution, and it's the only country in this world never respect and implement a UN resolution. Can you believe it? That is Israel. Palestinians cannot continue to in this manner and allow their land being persecuted, grabbed and confiscated. Palestinians have the right to have their own sovereign state today, better than tomorrow. And joining the United Nations is not something which we are doing it in order to delegitimize the state of Israel. We have said it in several occasions. We are there in order to strengthen and consolidate a political settlement based on the United Nations resolution. Nobody wanted to isolate Israel. We wanted to negotiate in order to reach a solution, but this negotiation cannot happen when settlements are being every day built on the heart of the Palestinian land. Settlement, it is the issue. I'm repeating that because you can't have a state when the land is being taken by somebody. Just recently, the government of Israel announced 1,100 new settlements in the heart of East Jerusalem. Let me tell you, friends, there will be no Palestinian leader will accept to abandon East Jerusalem and keep it under the Israeli occupation. East Jerusalem is part of the Palestinian land which was captured in 1967, and it has to be returned to the Palestinian people under the Palestinian leadership people's control. Jerusalem is the heart of the issue. Without Jerusalem, there will be no Palestine. And every single Israeli citizen should know this fact. And we have said, if the Israelis have certain requirements and certain concerns, we can sit and negotiate about it regarding certain issues in Jerusalem and the Palestinian territory. But it's not possible to have a permanent peace when settlements are being built. And when we say Prime Minister Netanyahu and his government should accept the basis of a future settlement should be based on 1967 borders, we mean it. He has to make a commitment, public commitment to the world, to his own people first, and to the other world community, that Palestine has to be full free country controlled by the Palestinian people. We are not going to be a small satellite state which will be controlled by Israel by remote control from Tel Aviv. It's not going to happen. We need full sovereign state over the Palestinian territory of 1967, with East Jerusalem as its capital. Yes, we have accepted the concept of negotiation, but you can't go and negotiate when Israel continues to grab land and confiscate land and bring foreigners into our land. If they have any historical claim, we have the same claim too. If they have religious claim of that land, we have the same. Our people are there. We are not foreigners. We are not strangers of that land. We are the indigenous of that land. We are the indigenous of that piece of land. My parents have come from Palestine, historical Palestine, from a place called Tarshiha, which the ambassador knows very well. He was expelled and kicked, and he lived all his life in a refugee camp in Lebanon, and died both of them there. And someone comes from Eastern Europe or from former Soviet Union and says, this land is mine. Is that justice? Thank you very much.
I will now move on to call on the Your Excellency the Ambassador of Israel, Dov Sechet Steinberg. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Welcome to share your thoughts with us. Mr.
Chairman, members of the committee, my friend and colleague Ambassador Ali Halima, dear guests, the situation in our part of the Middle East doesn't appear to make much sense at first glance. Israel has declared that it supports the establishment of two states for two peoples, which includes a Palestinian state and a Jewish state. The Palestinians say that they want a state, so why do two seemingly identical positions not lead to the expected outcome? The answer is simple. Both sides hold opposing views on the means to reach that goal. There is a gap between a state with peace and a state without peace. The future of the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians lies in that difference. Will the Palestinians have a country from which they launch further attacks on Israel, or will they build a country which will live in peaceful coexistence with their neighbor? I would like to take this opportunity to repeat my government's call to the Palestinian leadership, a call to return to the negotiating table without preconditions, so that genuine and lasting resolution can be found. Israel believes that the Palestinian state should be achieved as the result of a comprehensive and a genuine peace process. Direct negotiations remain the only means to reach agreement on that complicated issue that surrounds the establishment of a new state. However, from our perspective, it has become increasingly clear that the Palestinian Authority is not very interested in peace negotiations. This unfortunate turn of events is demonstrated by the ever-growing list of preconditions the Palestinians have set for the resumption of negotiations. The first precondition laid out by the PA was an end to the settlement activity. The 10-month moratorium on West Bank building initiated by Israel was ignored by them, and they started to negotiate only after 9.5 months. After 6 hours of talks, they abandoned negotiations once again. Then they demanded that before talks begin, Israel must surrender to their demands and recognize the 1949 ceasefire lines, ironically referred as the 67 borders, as the borders of a future Palestinian state. Now, there are press reports that the third precondition is on its way, a release of convicted Palestinian terrorists from Israeli jails. Furthermore, as part of their strategy of avoiding direct negotiations, they have chosen to disregard the urgent appeal issued by the Quartet on September 23rd to overcome the current obstacle and to resume direct bilateral Israeli-Palestinian negotiations without delay or preconditions. From Israel's perspective, the Palestinian Authority, led by President Abbas, is attempting to bypass talks and create a state without making peace with Israel first. This is the motivation behind the refusal to participate in serious negotiations for nearly 2 years, as well as the decision to turn to the UN for recognition. They seek a solution imposed from outside, but we know that imposed solutions cannot bring peace. All past attempts to impose solutions to the conflict from outside parties have failed. History in our conflict, as well as in the South African struggle, has shown that the peace treaties between Israel and its neighbors are possible, but they are only possible through negotiations between the parties. In this case as well, peace will only be achieved in direct negotiations. Now, instead of negotiating, the Palestinians are assailing Israel with diplomatic warfare. They have orchestrated a recognition via the UN in direct violation of the Oslo Accords that the PA had signed with Israel, which specifically forbid unilateral action to change the status on the West Bank and Gaza. In the name of peace, I hope that South Africa, as well as the entire international community, will reject those unilateral actions. Then, if the Palestinians collaborate, we can return to the negotiations and hopefully reach a true and lasting peace accord. In the meantime, while the Palestinians avoid direct negotiations, they are attempting to portray settlements as the true obstacle to peace. Yet, the Palestinians were waging war for decades before there was any single settlement in the West Bank. While the Palestinian Authority is engaging diplomatic warfare, the Hamas-ruled Gaza Strip is engaged in real warfare, firing missile after missile at the civilians of southern Israel, including last night. Last May, the Palestinian Authority entered into a recognition agreement with Hamas, disregarding the death organization covenant, which calls for the destruction of Israel and the killing of Jews, its rejection of any peace process, and its murderous terrorist attacks. Israel is facing, therefore, two Palestinian entities, one that strikes with violence, the other with diplomatic papers, one that uses Grad missiles, the other political plots. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Chairman, the only way the Palestinians will ever achieve a sustainable state is through direct negotiations aimed at putting an end to the conflict with Israel and establishing a relationship of peace and cooperation. For this reason, Israel has called time and time again for the return of the Palestinians to the negotiation table. We cannot understand why the international community, and especially South Africa, does not clarify to the Palestinian Authority that it cannot bypass peace talks and help persuade the Palestinians finally to return to the negotiating table for a direct dialogue with Israel. This is the South African way, and this is the right and only way to reach peace. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, we would like to follow what the ambassador said, to stress in a nutshell the geographies of Israel, which is smaller than Kruger Park, and the disputed territories, and as well as the security constraints in our geopolitical situation. So please bear with us.
Every state has the right of self-defense and to secure borders to protect itself from hostile invasions and terror. Israel is a small state surrounded by Arab countries 650 times its size, some of which are large bases of global terror. Only 44 miles separate between the Jordan Valley and the Mediterranean Sea. After the Six-Day War in 1967, when Israel was attacked by four armies on three fronts, United Nations Security Council Resolution 242 stated that Israel was entitled to new defensible borders to replace the previous fragile lines from which it was attacked. What are Israel's defensible borders? What are its essential security needs? The Jordan Rift Valley, Israel's eastern frontier, forms a natural barrier between Israel and the countries of Jordan, Iraq, and Iran. The Jordan Valley rises from an area that is 1,200 feet below sea level to a hilly ridge of up to 3,000 feet, creating a steep 4,200-foot virtual wall opposite any force attacking from the east. The growing threat of global jihad activity near Israel's borders requires it to prevent infiltrations of terrorists and weapons. When Israel left the Philadelphia corridor in Gaza, it became a highway for the infiltration of terrorists and flow of hundreds of tons of ammunition and weaponry from all over the Arab world, aimed at Israeli civilians. The Jordan Valley is the equivalent of Gaza's Philadelphia corridor in the West Bank. To defend itself, Israel must retain control over the Jordan Valley. This is Israel's mountain ridge, rising up to 3,000 feet. It dominates Israel's major coastal cities, where more than 70% of its population, 80% of its industry, and all of its airfields and seaports are located. Missiles launched from the Judean hills pose an immediate threat to Jerusalem, Israel's capital. Israel's only international airport, Ben Gurion, would be in the range of even primitive rockets, while all planes taking off and landing would be threatened by shoulder-launched anti-aircraft missiles. More advanced weaponry would be able to hit virtually any point in Israel. If Israel were forced back to the 1949 armistice lines, the Green Line, the country's width would be reduced to a narrow 9-mile waistline that would be impossible to defend. That's why any future arrangement must include Israeli control over key areas of the mountain ridge and the demilitarized Palestinian state. Israel's narrow borders means a combat aircraft can cross the entire country in under 4 minutes. In less than 2 minutes, an enemy plane could penetrate the country's airspace via the Jordan Valley and reach Jerusalem. In order to thwart an aerial attack on Jerusalem, a hostile plane must be shot down at least 10 miles east of the capital to prevent it from crashing into major population centers. Therefore, Israel must be able to identify hostile planes before they cross the Jordan River line and intercept them shortly after. To defend itself, Israel must control the airspace over the West Bank. Israel's transportation arteries, and in particular the Trans-Israel Highway, enable travel and connection between Israel's regions. They also assure the mobility of the Israel Defense Forces in case of attack. Protection of these vital arteries is essential in order to ensure that 1. Civilians aren't victims of terrorist gunfire. 2. Regions of the country cannot easily be cut off. 3. The mobility of Israel's defense forces is not hindered in the case of invasion. To defend itself, Israel must control its main arteries of transportation. There is enormous uncertainty about future trends in the Middle East. Iran is determined to become the supreme power as the U.S. withdraws from Iraq. No one can guarantee the future of many of the current regimes in the region. Today, more than ever, it is crucial to ensure defensible borders for Israel.
Often on the news, we hear the terms occupied territories, 67 borders, and illegal settlements. And the story we usually hear sounds very simple. During the Six-Day War, Israel captured the West Bank from the Palestinians, refused the United Nations' demand to retreat, and illegally built settlements. But is that really the case? Let's try to understand the situation a little bit better. We'll start with a simple but extremely important question. From whom did Israel capture the West Bank? From the Palestinians? No. In 1967, there was no Arab nation or state by the name of Palestine. Actually, was there ever? Israel took over the West Bank from Jordan in an act of self-defense, after Jordan joined a war launched by Egypt and Syria to destroy Israel. Oh, by the way, destroying countries is rather illegal. The United Nations back in 1967 rejected repeated Arab and Soviet attempts to declare Israel as the aggressor. Security Council Resolution 242 did not demand a unilateral Israeli withdrawal. Rather, the United Nations called for negotiating a solution which would leave Israel with secure and recognized boundaries. In effect, defensible borders. But wait a second. What was Jordan doing in the West Bank in the first place? What was its legal justification? Well, Jordan had the, you know what? It had no legal justification. Jordan simply occupied it during its previous attempt to destroy the newly established state of Israel in 1948, changing the commonly accepted name Judea and Samaria to the West Bank. But that did not really convince anybody. And almost no one recognized the legality of Jordan's occupation, not even any of the other Arab states. So, if Jordan had no legal claim to the land, and a Palestine did not exist, whose territory is it? Let's go a little further back in time. Don't worry, not to the days of the Bible, only about 100 years. Until 1917, the Ottoman Empire occupied the whole region. After losing in World War I, the Ottomans relinquished their 500-year control to the Allied forces, which decided to divide the old empire into countries. Britain's foreign minister, Lord Balfour, recognized the Jewish people's historical right to their homeland, a small area equivalent to about half of 1% of the Middle East was designated for this purpose. Britain received a mandate from the League of Nations to promote the establishment of a Jewish homeland. But wait a second, do you realize what happened? The Jewish homeland originally included not only the West Bank, but also the East Bank of the Jordan River. I guess you cannot say the Jewish people have not accepted some painful compromises already. Anyway, the League of Nations...
Ladies and gentlemen, I have from the WETCO requested that this, we know this is an emotive issue. Everybody is emotional about it. And everybody has his or her own strong view about it. So, but that exactly is the point of public discourse. That we engage from different perspectives, but we at least show the common decency to give each other the space to air those different perspectives that we have. And I'm really asking for everybody's indulgence. Some of you may or may not agree with, you know, with the views expressed in this clip. That's fine. It's somebody else's view. And let's at least respect their right to have that view, even if we do not agree with what the view is. So please, let's be tolerant. That's how we build our own democracy, since everybody's been talking about South Africa today. Let's be tolerant at least. You know, we will have an opportunity later to engage and take a different view from what you've been saying. Lastly, of course, already you are way beyond your time. Yes, I've spoken to the first speaker, I've indicated that already you are above your duty. No, I'm not going to argue with you. The point is that, but we're leaving you for you to finish this thing. Okay, but you're not going to get the other two that you're interested in. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because of the time constraints, we'll cut this clip short. We'll move to a shorter one of just 2 minutes, which expresses...
You are
abusing my charges. Sorry. So also, just finish this one. Okay.
How long is this?
This is like 4 more minutes. The last one, you want to change for 2 minutes?
The truth is that Israel wants peace. I want peace. So let's meet here today.
لا تقدموا لنا الدولة اليهودية لن نقبل بها. لن نقبل. لا تستطيع اللجنة الرباعية أن تفرض علينا شكل الدولة أو أن نعترف بطبيعة الدولة الإسرائيلية.
הרצון הלאומי שלנו הוא חד וצלול, להגיע לשלום עם שכנינו. ישראל תומכת, ויקום שתי מדינות ושני עמים.
מה עושה את הדולסטין לשעבים לבן אנחנו כי שעב יהודי, אולי אנחנו שעב פלסטין הון, אנחנו לן נחל את זה, לן למשוע לפרנזי ולן למשוע לפריק.
אנחנו רוצים שלום, שתי מדינות,
I am here with a message of peace. I believe that we can live together with the Palestinians.
Israel, إذا انسحبت من القدس، إسرائيل إذا خلعت المستوطنات 650 ألف مستوطن، إسرائيل إذا زاحت الجدار، إيش إسرائيل بيكون؟ إسرائيل بتنتهي.
مش وأكثر من غير معنى نحن لا نقبل. الاعتراف بالدولة بالدولة اليهودية.
The creation of the Palestinian state is the answer to this sensitive problem of the Palestinians.
But this is
the deal, basically. Peace treaty is our own interest. It's not a favor to the United States and not even to the Palestinians.
أي شخص يستطيع أن يقول أنا لا أعترف. ليس مطلوبا من حماس أو فتح أو الجبهة الشعبية أن تعترف بإسرائيل. جيد.
Israel will not be the last country to welcome a Palestinian state as a new member of the United Nations. It will be the first to do so.
Department of International Relations and Cooperation with the UNICEF to share some thoughts with us. Thank you.
Thank you, facilitator. I'm standing here today. My name is Johan Marx from the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. Standing here on behalf of Deputy Minister Fransman, who was due to be here to deliver the statement, but unfortunately he fell ill and he was hospitalized last night. So I was asked to read the statement here on his behalf. Honorable Chairperson, honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, their excellencies, Ambassadors Halime of Palestine and Segev Steinberg of Israel, other distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the Minister, who is currently accompanying the President on a state visit to some countries in the Arabian-Persian Gulf, I would like to thank you for this invitation to our department to participate in this very important symposium on the Middle East conflict, following the Palestinian bid for recognition as a state and its application to be accepted as a full member of the United Nations. The quest by the Palestinian people for a state of their own stretches over many decades, ever since the United Nations General Assembly adopted its Resolution 181 in 1947, providing for a division of the then British-mandated territory of Palestine into separate territories for the Palestinian and Jewish inhabitants of this ancient land. A few months later, following the official end of the British presence in Palestine, the Jewish inhabitants in May 1948 declared the establishment of the State of Israel. This resulted in a war between five neighboring Arab countries and the newly born Israeli state during 1948 and 1949, ending with armistice lines running through the west bank of the Jordan River and East Jerusalem, which today, some 62 years later, form the basis on which the Palestinian National Authority under President Mahmoud Abbas has indicated that the borders of a free and independent Palestine should be established. Ever since South Africa's democratic transformation in 1994, successive ANC-led administrations in our country have strongly supported the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people to a state of their own, existing side by side in peace with Israel within internationally recognized borders. This commitment has its origin in our own lengthy struggle for freedom and democracy in our own country, when as a liberation movement, we fought side by side with the Palestinian Liberation Organization for justice and liberty in our respective parts of the world. Today, we enjoy this freedom and democracy, while our Palestinian brothers and sisters are still waiting for theirs. The question thus arises, what lessons can we bring from our own experience in this country, which could assist not only the Palestinian nation, but also the people of Israel, to move forward to a lasting and peaceful solution. Such a solution should ensure the realization of the cherished dream of Palestinians for a viable Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, with East Jerusalem as its capital, but at the same time address the valid concerns of the State of Israel for its security and acceptance in the region as a permanent presence in the Middle East. In looking at the South African experience, let me acknowledge at the outset that in our engagement with each other as South Africans, we did not have the burden of hundreds, if not thousands, of years of history, which is carried by two of the world's great religions, Judaism and Islam, and their respective peoples, sharing the tiny holy land, hardly larger in all than the Kruger National Park. We did share with them, however, centuries of injustice and discrimination, as well as colonial rule. But in deciding to end our racial divide and move forward together towards a common future, we were determined to recognize and accept each other's existence and right of presence in a common nationality in this great land. In the case of the Middle East conflict, we as South Africans accept that Israelis and Palestinians have embarked on a different path, namely of two states, two peoples. In our view, it is not for the international community to prescribe what the route to peaceful coexistence should be. That is the decision which rests with the two nations. Our task, and that of the international community, as our government sees it, is to fully support their common endeavors to arrive successfully at their envisaged destination. Despite the widely differing end goals between South Africa and the Middle East peace process, we do believe that there are lessons to be learned from the South African negotiating experience, which might assist Israelis and Palestinians alike to achieve their respective goals. All those of us who lived through those turbulent years of the early 1990s, which included much regional violence, the Boy Patong massacre, and the death of Steve Biko, will clearly recall on what a knife edge this country then was. That we managed to transcend all those tragedies was, in my view, principally due to an understanding, certainly in the ANC leadership, that we had to address each other's fears and concerns if we were to move forward together to a common future. This understanding led to a step-by-step approach in which trust was gradually built up between initially mistrustful people on both sides of the ideological separation wall of apartheid, resulting in a common and collective effort to break down this wall, much as the physical Berlin Wall had been broken down only a few years earlier. But also key to our successful efforts was the understanding that it had to be an all-inclusive process, with all parties, whether on the extreme left or the extreme right, big or small, being invited to participate. No one was excluded from the process, whether they had officially renounced violence or not, except by their own free will. In looking at the Middle East conflict within this framework, one gets a sense that despite all the years of negotiation since the Oslo peace process, which roughly coincided with our own CODESA negotiations at Kempton Park, no real trust has effectively been established between all the parties involved in the conflict. Some factions on both sides still appear to be pursuing goals seen as unrealistic by most of the international community, namely ones which will ensure that the winner takes all. Compromise, in our view, is essential, and only possible if the playing fields are levelled, much as they were in South Africa from the outset of the negotiating process, with the unbanning of the liberation movements and the freeing from many years of incarceration of some of their key leaders, such as our great icon, Nelson Mandela. For it is evident that negotiations between equals is only possible if the dominating position of one of the parties is dismantled, as happened gradually in South Africa in the case of the apartheid government with its racial laws and powerful military machine. For their part, the liberation movements did not agree to renounce violence, but only to suspend it until the successful outcome of the negotiations. In the case of the Middle East conflict, it is evident that there is as yet no levelling of the playing field. The Israeli military, one of the most powerful forces for its size in the world, continues to occupy the West Bank and East Jerusalem, recognized by most of the international community as occupied Palestinian territory. This involves not only hundreds of military checkpoints, where individual Palestinians undergo daily humiliations, creating resentment and bitterness in successive generations, but also the occupying by some 500,000 Israeli settlers of land which had been home to generations of Palestinians for hundreds of years. In the coastal enclave of Gaza, Israeli land, sea and air forces continue to blockade the small strip of land, home to some 1.5 million Palestinians. The South African government sees this as collective punishment of a population living without hope of a better life. Such actions cannot build mutual trust any more than rockets and other attacks by some Palestinian factions against Israeli cities and civilians. None of these actions can bring about lasting solutions, but only contribute to maintaining the divide between the two peoples. The refusal by the Israeli government to halt Israeli settlement expansion in the occupied Palestinian West Bank and East Jerusalem was given by President Abbas and the Palestinian National Authority as a reason for breaking off renewed talks with the Israeli government at the end of September 2010, less than a month after they were started in Washington under the United States auspices. This in turn led to the PNA decision to approach the United Nations at the regular annual session of the General Assembly in September this year for acceptance as a full member of the United Nations and as a state. In terms of the UN Charter, this approach needs to be endorsed by the UN Security Council, before being referred to the UN General Assembly. To date, the Palestinian bid has not been voted on in the UN Security Council due to the opposition principally by the United States, which has made it clear that it will use its veto power on this issue. The alternative is for the Palestinians to approach the UN General Assembly for non-member status or non-member observer status as a state, a position that is enjoyed by the Vatican. Whatever the outcome of this process, the South African government strongly supports the Palestinian request for international recognition as a state and full membership of the United Nations. We have bilaterally long since recognized Palestine as a state, namely in 1995, when an agreement for the opening of a Palestinian embassy in South Africa was signed. As such, we will continue to support, as a current member of the UN Security Council, the Palestinians towards the achievement of their goal. In doing so, we call on the people and government of Israel not to see this Palestinian quest as a threat to their existence, but as a way of leveling the playing fields between the two sides. If a majority of Israelis come to accept that they are no longer occupying disputed territory, but the land of another internationally recognized state, they may feel the need to restart serious negotiations with their Palestinian partners aimed at ensuring peace and security for themselves and the Palestinian people for the generations to come. The South African government remains ready to assist, along with the rest of the international community, both parties, to overcome whatever obstacles would then remain to achieve this very elusive but most definitely realizable goal, much as we achieved our own dreams, which for many decades had seemed unattainable. We feel that this quest is particularly relevant at a time when ordinary people in other countries in the Middle East and North Africa have risen up in protest against the continued denial of their basic human and democratic rights and challenged existing orders to achieve their freedom and dignity. As South Africans, who were so long denied similar rights, we strongly support this impressive movement towards justice and liberty. Honourable Chairperson, honourable members of the Portfolio Committee, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you.
Members of the committee, you have a big job ahead of you, which I listen to all the multiple points of view and the really strong views that are coming through, and it's not about to end. We have a keynote address coming up by Mr. Naeem Jina. I think you can come and join us in front. She's sitting at the table. I think Naeem comes from the Afro-Middle East Center, and on occasion I do receive some of your papers that you send out on your email distribution, and they are always really interesting reading material. As a researcher, we are addicted to reading, so please come and share your thoughts with us on this issue. Do a much better introduction. Naeem is the executive director of the Johannesburg-based Afro-Middle East Center. He's an academic who keenly has followed developments in the Middle East over the years, and he has taught political studies at the University of Witwatersrand. And the Afro-Middle East Center was formed in 1998 and is a research institute focused on the Middle East, Africa, and Middle East Africa relations in particular. It also prepares policy proposals for the South African government and other parties on these issues. And I think in the period that we are in, the relations between the African continent and the Middle East is very important, especially in the context of events in North Africa. So thank you for your contribution.
Members of the committee, members of the diplomatic corps, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Members of the committee, let me just say that I think that my presentation here, will, apart from yourselves, from the others listening to the presentation this morning, will receive a unanimous response. No one is going to like a lesson. So I'm going to not address the other people who have spoken today and address you, members of the committee. This session, of course, and much of the attention on the Palestine question in the past few months is due to the United Nations membership bid by the Palestinian Authority, or technically by the PLO. In that regard, the bid has achieved one of its objectives. Indeed, this General Assembly session will be known mainly for the debate around the issue of the bid for membership by the PLO. But the bid itself is much more than, of course, a PR exercise. We know, of course, that South Africa's position, as was just reflected in the speech by the Deputy Minister, is to support the bid. And clearly that is from where South Africa comes, that is an understandable and correct position. However, the bid itself has not been without debate. And I'm not talking about the debate between Israelis and Palestinians, but particularly among Palestinians themselves, the bid has not been without debate. And so while the case has been made in this hall for the bid, I want to present also that there is a Palestinian view against the bid. Salah, for example, in a conference just a week ago, and Salah is a member of the Palestinian National Council, and interestingly, in charge of the portfolio for refugee affairs for the PLO. Salah at a conference just about a week ago said that the bid was a mistake and that in fact would do more damage for the Palestinian cause. It was, of course, an expression of frustration by the Palestinian Authority in the way that the negotiation process has been treated, in the way in which all the doors to it have been closed in the recent past. And in that frustration, an attempt to escalate the matter and taking this bid to the United Nations. Frustration, however, is not necessarily enough of a reason to have a debate on such an issue at the United Nations. Now, why has there been the opposition that I speak of, apart from Salah, other Palestinian groups, Palestinian organizations, particularly Palestinian civil society organizations? In the main, Palestinian political factions have supported the bid, in the main, with one or two exceptions. But civil society organizations have argued against it, quite vociferously in many cases. The one reason is that currently there is a seat for the Palestinian people at the United Nations. It's a seat for an observer entity, not observer state, but observer entity. The PLO is recognized by the United Nations as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. If this bid were to succeed, that seat would, of course, be taken away because Palestinians can't have two seats. That seat would be taken away and the seat would be given to a Palestinian state, which would represent not all the Palestinian people, but the citizens of the West Bank and Gaza, which means that Palestinian refugees, 5 million or whatever of them, would not be represented in the United Nations. And as currently is the case, Palestinians in Israel are in fact, they call it represented by the PLO, would not be represented at the United Nations. And so the role of the PLO seat would be drastically reduced, is the argument. The concern then is that in fact the issue of the Palestinian refugees would disappear from the United Nations agenda, because they will not have a representation at the United Nations. The third point, and I'm not going to go through all the arguments, but the third point is that, in fact, if the bid were to succeed, that it would result in no real change in facts on the ground. The occupation will continue as brutally as it has. There will be no territorial change, and there will be no recognition by Israel, as Israel has made clear. Now, this is the position if the bid succeeds. We know, of course, that the bid is not going to succeed. It seems pretty clear that even the 9 votes required will not be attained at the Security Council. That's quite clear. In fact, the Palestinian Authority Foreign Minister, Riyad Malki, has already said that the PA is planning its strategy based on the assumption that the bid will not succeed. South Africa, of course, will vote for the bid in the Security Council, but it's doubtful that Nigeria would, Gabon almost certainly wouldn't, and nor will Bosnia-Herzegovina. These are three of the nine countries which already recognize Palestine as a state. And if they got the nine votes, of course the United States has promised that it will veto it, and this is one promise that I think we can expect that they will stand by. So it won't succeed. What then are the implications of the failure of the bid? Firstly, some of the implications we are already seeing. The United States has already decided to cut its funding to the Palestinian Authority, and of course we know to UNESCO. Israel has already begun withholding Palestinian taxes, customs duties, etc., which of course is clear theft of Palestinian funds, but that is a position that has been taken. There's an increase in intransigence from an extreme right-wing Israeli government towards the Palestinian issue as a result of the bid. And as the United States prepares for presidential elections, Palestinians can expect no ease and sympathy from that quarter on these issues. So winning the bid could be highly problematic. Losing the bid, as is clear will happen, comes with a separate set of problems. All of this is leading then to a number of things, the implications. Firstly, the end of the peace process as we know it. I know some people would want to put quotation marks around the word peace process, but I'll leave it as it is. Secondly, a fairly rapid implosion of the Palestinian Authority, an implosion which has already begun. And to quote Azam Al Ahmad, who's an advisor, I think would be correct to say, of President Mahmoud Abbas, very close to President Mahmoud Abbas, in some ways regarded as a confidant, maybe not entirely so, but quite close to President Abbas. In an interview that was published just 2 days ago in an Arab newspaper, he said that the Palestinian Authority is collapsing. He made it clear that there are no plans to disband it, and it sounded from the tone that you would prefer disbanding, because at least that could be controlled, but it was collapsing. His reasons for why he thinks that it's collapsing are firstly, the undermining and failure of the peace process. Secondly, the ongoing occupation of the West Bank. And thirdly, what he calls the Israeli theft of Palestinian lands, of Palestinian funds, what I mentioned earlier on. And so he says that the Palestinian Authority is collapsing and basically it's not rescuable, is his argument. I have, if anyone wants, translations of excerpts of that interview that I can pass on. This, despite the fact that the Palestinian Authority, in fact, in the way it has operated, it has been forced to operate, has been the outsourcing agent of the occupation. It has, in a sense, served its purpose for the occupation, and it will not be protected any longer. The UN membership bid, then, will result in much more than its architects expected. It spells, in fact, the end of an era and the beginning of another. Of course, not only for the Palestinians are things changing rapidly, they are for Israel as well. And so let me dwell for a moment or two on Israel. And I'm dwelling only for moments here and there on Israel, because I really think, honorable members of the committee, that the South African government should be less concerned about Israel and more concerned about the Palestinians. But I'll say later why I say so. Israel, despite its strident rhetoric, its enhanced hasbara, and a government that has remained united, amazingly so, in spite of all the challenges it has faced internally and externally, faces its own uncertainties and difficulties. You might not think so if you saw how Prime Minister Netanyahu scolded and berated the President of the United States of America in the White House. But that is perhaps more a reflection of Obama's weakness than it is of Netanyahu's strength. What are the difficulties that Israel faces then? Firstly, we are finding the democratization of the region in which Israel is located. Now, despite whatever the Israeli representatives might say, I don't believe that Israel is thrilled about the fact that democracy is coming to the region. It is, in fact, a serious problem for the Israeli state. For example, look at Egypt and what the future of Egypt might hold for a democratic Egypt might hold for the Israeli state. Already, in preparation for that democracy, there's tough talk from the Egyptian side. The Israeli ambassador was forced to flee Egypt, in fact, by the people, by demonstrators, by protesters. Look at Jordan and how, following on the Egyptian example where the Israeli ambassador was forced to flee, a similar thing happened in Jordan. The uncertainty regarding Syria. If Assad's government falls, that's another discussion that we could have, but if Assad's government falls, I think the uncertainty could be really problematic for Israel in terms of who might take power and what their policies might be to the Israeli state. So that on the one hand, in terms of the democratization within the region. Secondly, the internal dissension within Israel is accentuating fault lines within Israeli society. The 10 protests recently is just one indication of that. Thirdly, the constant increase in the size of the refusenik movement in Israel, soldiers or young citizens who are refusing to serve in the Israeli Defense Force, just don't have the kind of passion that is required and find every means that they can in order not to serve. Israel, of course, has a conscript army. Next, the loss in the region of Turkey as an ally has had serious repercussions for Israel and will have serious repercussions for Israel. And final point that I want to make on this, a change in the power balance between Palestinians. The stronger Palestinian party that Israel was relating to in the past is no longer necessarily the stronger Palestinian party. And all of these put together puts Israel in a different situation than it was even a year ago. From various perspectives then, the future cannot continue on the same trajectory as the past has been, for all parties concerned. On the Palestinian front, as the Palestinian Authority / Fatah sees its decline, there are other rising political actors. And I want to speak of two. Firstly, of course, Hamas, which, as we know, won the parliamentary elections in 2006, and has gained renewed confidence through the uprisings in the Middle East North African region. And pardon me if I don't use the catchphrase Arab Spring. I don't like it. I don't think it's correct. So Hamas is one of those rising actors. The other is an increasingly confident civil society, buoyed by recent successes in its so-called BDS campaign, boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns globally. These are the actors that South Africa is going to have to deal with and respond to as we move forward from this point on. Let me say a few things then about each of these two. About Hamas. With the MENA uprisings that have taken place, what we have found is increasingly greater legitimacy being given to various Islamist organizations in these countries. So we find, for example, the United States is having dialogue with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, is talking to Al-Nahda in Tunisia, etc. The European Union is doing the same. Actually, the European Union has been talking to many of these organizations from before. Jordan, I mean, the King of Jordan has suddenly become great friends with Hamas and with the Muslim Brotherhood in his own country. Syria is a big exception, of course. The Assad government still doesn't like the Muslim Brotherhood, and I don't think ever will. Within this context of the legitimization of Islamist movements in the region, and the attempt by the bigger powers, the attempt through this engagement to, quote-unquote, moderate these organizations, within this context, we also find Hamas. And Hamas's legitimacy is increasing then not only among people in the Arab world, but also among these various different powers that I'm talking about. Jordan, I said, you know, I mean, the king had a media conference with the head of Hamas recently. the United States, the EU, etc., etc. So we find this greater kind of legitimizing of these Islamist movements, including Hamas. The Gilad Shalit deal recently, I think, should also be seen. I'm not saying this was the main reason that the deal happened. Of course, it's been in the making for 5 years. But the rapidity with which this last stage actually took place, I think that deal should also be seen within the context of this kind of greater legitimizing of a global legitimizing of the Islamist movement, and particularly Hamas. It is likely, and on this I can't say for sure, but I would be surprised if it were not the case that Israel has begun some kind of back channel talks with Hamas or elements within Hamas in different kinds of ways. I don't believe that the Israeli state structures are as silly as not to do that. So there's the attempt then, in a sense, to view the Islamists in all of these countries that I'm talking about as the moderates. It's a very new kind of phenomenon, but it's a phenomenon that comes about as a result of what has happened over the past 11 months, and the fact that the Islamists are the major party in Tunisia now, will be the major party in Egypt, etc. As far as Palestinian civil society that I was talking about is concerned, Palestinian civil society, NGOs, etc., have long been dominated by Palestinian groups which have been aligned to particular political factions, whether it was Fatah, the PFLP, DFLP, Communist Party, etc. Over the recent past, that has changed, and Palestinian civil society is much more independent of political groups. With the weakening of the Palestinian Authority, firstly, and secondly, with the successes of these civil society groups on the global stage, especially around his BDS campaign, and if you want to know how successful they've been, you should look at the Israeli propaganda about it, which acknowledges those successes. With all of this, Palestinian civil society will increasingly be an important political player in Palestinian society. Now, my final section that I want to deal with, and that is... My final section, which really is what all of this has, in a sense, attempted to build up to, and that is, how should the South African government respond to these changes, because these are changes in the region and in what's happening in the Palestinian situation. How should it respond to these changes in a way that it remains relevant to the situation in, another term I feel a bit uncomfortable about, but nevertheless, in the new Middle East? So I want to make a few points about this. I should just make a note here, however, before I continue with these points. And that note is that, certainly from our interaction with various role players in the Middle East, I'm not just talking about Palestine-Israeli context, but generally across the Middle East, and Muslim world, there's increasingly a perception that South Africa is becoming more and more irrelevant to the region. This is a perception that I think needs to be changed. It needs to be changed, and I think that South Africa needs to increase its visibility in action around the region. It's a perception that has been in the making for the past 2 or 3 years, but with the rapidity of events in that region in the past 11 months, 2 or 3 years is a long time. So we need to change that kind of perception, not just for the sake of looking like we're doing something, but because I believe for South Africa, the region is important. So let me move on to say to talk about what I think, how I think South Africa should be responding. A few points here. Firstly, it seems to me that the South African government and the ANC have disabused themselves of the idea of being a possible mediator between the Israelis and Palestinians. This is a good thing, because really, despite what Israelis might like to say in order to keep South Africa in a particular box, the reality is that South Africa can't play a mediating role between Israelis and Palestinians. You have one party in these two that has the support of the only superpower in the world. Why do they need South Africa to mediate? The idea of keeping South Africa occupied with the notion that it can be a mediator is to keep it occupied in a way that it will not clearly come out supporting the Palestinian struggle. I think that notion of being a mediator, as the South African government has dropped it, and I think that's a good thing. The new focus, I believe, from the South African government needs to be on the Palestinian people rather than mediating between the Israelis and Palestinians. We have a role to play. I'm part of the South African government. Sorry. The government has a role to play in helping to develop, strengthen, and maintain Palestinian unity, number one. Number two, and related to the first one, the government and the ANC have a role to play and should be playing a role in assisting with the reform of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. I think these are two critical challenges that are faced by the Palestinian people, both of them, and I think that these are two critical areas where the South African government and the ANC can play important roles, and where they would be accepted to play important roles. I know that there are certain challenges. One challenge, for example, is that Egypt regards the whole PLO, as the Arabs would say, the PLO file, as being its domain, and you can't talk about it unless you talk to them. There are these kinds of challenges, but I think that South Africa can still surmount these and play that kind of role. South Africa needs to see itself as a friend of the Palestinian people rather than a friend of any particular political faction among Palestinian society. And so it must maintain an equidistance between all political factions among the Palestinian people. South Africa's approach also to the broader question must be one that is in pursuit of international law at all levels. South Africa is a state, an important state on the global stage, and its basis needs to be international law, and that's what it needs to pursue. We need to pursue a value-based and interest-driven policy on the Middle East with a multilateral/multipolar approach. We must then also be prepared, despite what I said about our main focus, we must be prepared to listen to Palestinians, but we must also be prepared to listen to Israelis and what they have to say on these issues, if we want a multipolar approach to be successful. This despite the fact that the current Israeli government is an extremist government, which, apart from the way it deals with Palestinians, just among its own citizens, we are seeing increasingly curbs on free speech, we're seeing restrictions on Israeli NGOs, even creating distinctions between what are left-wing and right-wing NGOs, etc. This is among Israelis themselves. So from that perspective, it is an extremist government in many ways. But the reality is that it exists, and the South African government has to deal with them. And so when we're talking about the term I've used a few times, moderate and moderation, I think that moderation should be demanded by the South African government from the Israeli government as well. South Africa should follow the international trend then in terms of its relationships in the region and the forces with whom it develops those relations. This implies that it must position itself within the broader legitimization of the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamist organizations in the region. If you want to deal with a new Tunisia, if you want to deal with a new Egypt, you're going to have to accept that these are the forces at play, and you're going to have to understand what these forces are, who they are, what they believe, and how they want to move forward. And that process is in itself, as the United States is now understanding, is a process of moderation in itself. Hence, in the Palestinian case, South Africa must, as I said earlier, remain equidistant from all factions and be particularly attuned to Hamas and the moderate Islamist trend within Palestinian society. Not fall into the trap of demonizing one Palestinian faction over another. It is a trap that certainly is being put forward to the South African government by many forces, not only Israelis. It is necessary that we position ourselves with our strategic partners globally on a kind of moderate middle path in terms of how we deal with the Palestinian-Israeli question, and partner with other organizations that want to other countries rather, that want to pursue a path of peace in that region, even if sometimes the approach might be different to the one we might want to undertake. For example, Turkey. We must maintain an independent foreign policy, of course, in general, but specifically talking about the Middle East, we must maintain an independent foreign policy regarding the MENA uprisings, even at the risk of harsh responses. And we know the harsh responses that our friends in DIRCO get, from particularly from the Americans, whenever they are critical of this or that party in as far as the Middle East is concerned. In the context of the Israeli-Palestinian issue, to use a phrase which I think has now become somewhat discredited, but nevertheless, in the context of the Israeli-Palestinian issue, South Africa needs to develop a zero-conflict policy. That is, with regards to its relationship with Fatah, with Hamas, with other political Palestinian political factions, and with Israel. This doesn't mean condoning any violations committed by any of these parties or governments. In fact, South Africa should be vociferous against any violations, but it needs to maintain a position where it is able to not be in conflictual state with these. Such a policy also offers us the opportunity to circumvent the problem of navigating within religious, political, and other kinds of sectarian divides in the region. Ultimately, South Africa needs to see a future for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that is, of course, a negotiated settlement with just solutions on particularly the so-called final status issues. And perhaps a re-look in this context at the Arab League proposal, which has in a sense been shelved in the recent past. But I think that it is necessary that we re-look at that proposal for ways of moving forward. My final point, and I kind of slipped this in because I really didn't want to talk about this, but I decided to slip it in, partly because it's part of the theme for today, and that is, what are the lessons from South Africa's negotiating experience? Firstly, let me say that the reason I didn't want to speak about this is because I think in the context of the Palestinian-Israeli situation right now, this discussion is misplaced. The Israeli-Palestinian context is nowhere near the kind of negotiations that we spoke about, that we speak about when we talk about the period between 1990 and 1994. It's nowhere near there. And so drawing comparisons or drawing lessons from one to the other is somewhat misplaced. But nevertheless, let me make one or two points. From our experience, discussions and talks cannot be based on preconditions made by the dominant oppressive player. In that case. And Zaki pointed out earlier on that in fact the preconditions upon which the talks were based were preconditions made by the liberation movement, not by the apartheid government. We must accept that the liberation movements have the right to maintain their right to all forms of struggle. This was the case in our situation. When did the ANC suspend its armed struggle? When did the PAC, or did the PAC ever suspend its armed struggle? we know that Nelson Mandela insisted that that will not happen until 1-2-3. We know that didn't happen in 1990, it didn't happen in 1991, despite all these minutes and discussions, etc. It happened in 1993, okay? Right up to that point, there was the maintenance of the right that we can continue an armed struggle. In fact, it was in that period that we heard of Operation Gula, not in the 1980s. It was also in the period 1990 to 1994 that more people were killed in South Africa in political violence than the entire rest of our experience under apartheid. That's quite telling. So the notion that you say, we're willing to talk to you, but there must be no killing of people, well, no killing of people from your side, which is what is being asked of Palestinians, is not a lesson that we learn from our experience. So if you want to use our experience, then that is the case. If I might throw in a personal note here, that You know, one thing that really upsets me is when I often get told in forums such as these and others that, you know, if only the Palestinians were like the ANC and like Nelson Mandela. You know, Mandela was sentenced to life on Robben Island because of his peaceful struggle. Nelson Mandela wasn't a Gandhiist. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't sentenced because he was practicing Satyagraha. He was sentenced because he had started the armed struggle and was a founding member of Mkhonto we Sizwe. That's why he was tried. So that notion is very insulting to people like Nelson Mandela and people like my brother, and this is my personal note, who wasn't killed waving a white flag. He was killed with an AK-47 in his hand. So the notion that we can only talk, and by the way, he was killed with an AK-47 in his hand in January 1994. So the notion that, you know, we can't deal with you unless you put down your weapons, we'll keep all our stocks, of course, but, you know, is not one that we learn from our experience. These then are our lessons. And when the time is right, then we can revisit these lessons and we can bring them into play. Right now, I don't think that is the time. Thank you.
I'm just going to draw a few things that struck me from your presentation. I think also to focus it for the honourable members of the Parliament Committee, because I think the primary question is how, not only immediately but also into the future, how will South Africa respond on a policy level to this? And I think one of the most interesting things that struck me from your presentation is the conditions inside the Palestinian Authority. I think in terms of engaging with questions of conflict and how we can move even wider than just the Palestinian-Israel conflict, if we look into conflict in the Sudan, or if we look into conflict in even the Democratic Republic of Congo, often our outside understanding has to be based on a very deep knowledge and understanding of what's happening inside. And I think there is a big job to be done to understand those conditions and what are the threats to organizations or the opportunities. And I think that's something that I think is very helpful in just kind of creating the context in terms of how do we ultimately engage with this question. So that's one specific issue. Also the interesting one that you mentioned on South Africa can play a role in the process of, I would say, engaging with the multiple sides internally in Palestine, regardless of their orientation or a specific political position. I think that's also something important to build relationships of trust across the boundaries. And now I'm going to throw another, maybe an adventurous thought in. And this is also a very personal comment. I'm quite excited about the establishment of the South African Development Partnership Agency. As I understand, the director will launch that in the next year. Now, I wonder sometimes in terms of engaging with these kind of questions, whether South Africa cannot use a vehicle like that very effectively in a case like Palestine to build those bridges. To engage with parties regardless of who you are, where you come from, or what your objectives are, but to build a relationship. I think that is something Zirko can consider in terms of its engagement in the future with the Palestinian-Israel question. Another important thing that came, I think, from Naeem's lecture or talk is the question of Egypt. I honestly think that South African engagement with the Israel-Palestine question cannot move without a new engagement with Egypt. And this happens in the context of very significant change inside the country as well. So I think in terms of the challenge to the members of the committee, but also to Gurkha in terms of formulating South African policy, is to design strategies to engage with these emerging players inside of Egypt, inside of Palestine, and in that way to build also not only our South African understanding, but also to build relationships and bridges. So I think that the Egyptian component or the Egyptian role, and maybe as Egypt slowly but surely moves towards or through its own internal transition towards democracy, I think there may be a new platform for engagement between South Africa and Egypt. Because South Africa, I think, has had a very difficult time in the past engaging in North Africa, especially due to Egypt's historical power in the region. Now, based on the principles of democracy and moving towards a more open, transparent type of society, I think on that basis, South Africa can engage with the new players in Egypt and then also seek in that way to bridge some of the very complicated divides and that runs through the region. I can also continue talking about this, and my job isn't to be a presenter. I think according to the program, I think the big job now will be to move into a discussion on the check. That's how we will. Just an indication for you, according to the program, we have a lunch scheduled for one sitting. Is that correct? So we can have a discussion then from now until 1:25. Okay, there's first hand. Do we have a mic that we can send around?
Yeah.
Can someone just assist us with the mic? I will recognize the first person there with the purple shirt.
No, just in response to a question that was raised, I think it would be proper for the honourable members to raise their questions for clarity and so on. As the committee will still engage on the matter upon receiving all these briefings from the various people around here. So for their engagement, I agree with you, honourable members, that it will be limited to questions for clarity.
So we take first from the members of the committee.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is just to also just first of all say thank you very much for the presentation that we've been exposed to, and that I think it has a lot of help to expose us to what's really happening. That region. Some of us have had opportunity to travel to Israel in the year 2010. My colleague here, under the auspices of another organization, that showed us just exactly what's going on there. But of course, we didn't have the chance to go on the other side to see what's happening also there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I believe we have a trip organized next week. Some of us to go on to the other side as well, just to see and balance the issues and see. What the picture is like. But I think this has been a very, very helpful session for us. So at the committee, we can really get to understand the issues. But besides that, I just wanted to find out the role of the regional organization in resolving the issue of Israel-Palestine. I'm asking this because, well, in the region here, in the southern African region, SADC has played quite a significant role in trying to resolve some of the issues that have been grappling the region. The AU, of course, with its failures, has assisted as well in a number of issues. But I just want to know, what has been the role of regional organizations in the region that you are focusing on? Thank you.
Thank you. Just what would help us is it was mentioned that one of the preconditions, of course, was the Freedom Charter. And I was wondering if both ambassadors would just clear for us the understanding, what would you see as the equivalent of the Palestinian Authority or Hamas sort of Freedom Charter and Israel, the commitment of Israel to human rights? Where do you see your equivalent of the Freedom Charter, your commitment to human rights for all, and particularly minority rights? If you could just expand a bit on that for us. And then the South African government statement, if the Israeli ambassador could just comment on that and its implication for Israel, and would it make any difference to the insecurities of Israel if countries like South Africa were to take a less partisan view and show some concern when Israel is under attack? Does it impact in any way? And then just very briefly, we saw that clip setting out the vulnerability of Israel. Now, how does this impact on the lives of people living in Israel?
Does it have a serious impact in terms of the daily life of the people of Israel? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chair, I accept that we can't exhaust everything here, and I take it that maybe next week we should probably
into more serious, not serious, but a little bit more technical discussion because of the time factor today. So I'll just ask very few things. I'll start with the last speaker and ask everything that I heard you said. I appreciate your input and thank you very much for that. But don't you project South Africa as a superpower then in the kind of proposals that you are putting, and is it really a right thing to do that to us? I must thank you for assisting in correcting the historical and not a distortion of our history in the country. Really for the following reasons. I will never forget the day that Mandela was sworn in as president of the country. There was a moment when all these jets and so on came over. The majority of us literally ducked because we thought we were going to be shot. We thought the storm was going to be shot. When we realized these bombs and these aircraft are not coming for us, then we got up. We were crying, realized that we actually were not shot. So I think we must be careful, everyone, when we try to engage in the historicalness of South Africa and its negotiating part, because it doesn't help you to be selective in saying South Africa's position must be to the one of the negotiations that are Kodisa. It's not only that. You're really not doing yourself a favor by boxing us in this way. I must tell you that many of us have to really redeem ourselves with some of the things that we heard here today, because for some of us they remain extremely emotional on the path that we have taken and how we got here, and the day when many MPs were sworn in and they had to confront the realities of we are now sitting across each other. Those things haven't gone away very easily, and they're still probably not all of us here. So I think we must be sensitive to the South African part and what we have done and how we got there, because you do force us into particular positions if you misquote our historical path that we have taken. So I want to ask the both Israel and lastly, Chair, both Israel and Palestine, everything else that you are saying, you know, persuades me it must be the UN that must help you along. But isn't your issue the land issue more than anything else? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair President. Two questions that I have. The first one based on what Ambassador Halimah said, that Palestinian UN membership is good for Israel. I want to hear both perspectives. That the Palestinian UN membership is good for Israel. Now, what is the understanding of the Palestinian ambassador? In what good is he referring to, and the understanding of the Israeli ambassador? And the second one is about Jerusalem. The ambassador said they have both a religious place. I know that you wanted to stay away from religious issues, but the statement was made that they both have a religious place. I want to have a clearer understanding of that place and whether Jerusalem and, appears in both their books, the book of the Muslims and the book of the Jews, and how many times the word Jerusalem appears. Thank you.
I think in terms of responses, I would ask, could we take responses to the honourable members' questions, and then I will come to your question. Naeem, your response first, then Your Excellency, Ambassador Israel, your response, and Ambassador Ali.
I have two questions, and so two quick responses. Firstly, the role of regional organisations in resolving the issue. The main regional organization in that region is the Arab League. And the response of the Arab League over the past 60 years has been quite varied. At sometimes military responses, etc. The most recent political response is the Arab League initiative. which provides some kind of a roadmap in moving forward, and that's what I said. I think that members of the committee and the South African government should re-look at in terms of providing a way in which things can move forward. Beyond that, I think the Arab League is quite hamstrung in how it responds. I mean, just as the South African government in the 70s or 80s would balk at anything that was said to them by the SADCC or the OAU, similarly would Israel. Congress September, isn't South Africa projected as a superpower in my presentation? I realize that might be a bit like how it seems. But it's precisely for that reason that I said that that it's good that we've disabused ourselves of the notion that we can play a mediating role. We are not a superpower. We can't play that kind of role. But what we can do is work with Palestinians, because Palestinians and South Africans, the PLO and South African liberation movements have a long history. And our, as the ANC, as the South African government, and I think as the South African people, we have a particular kind of commitment to the cause of the Palestinian people. And I think that our role should be in assisting Palestinians. And the primary challenges that they face at the moment is the question of unity / reconciliation and the issue of the reform of the organization, which is regarded as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people by the UN, but which organization in reality doesn't really exist. And there's calls from all sides in the Palestinian society for it to be reconstructed, revived, and for new elections to the PNC. I think that's where South Africa can assist. And you don't have to be a superpower to do that. You have to be a friend of the Palestinians, which I think we are.
Thank you very much. I refer to a few questions. First of all, with regard to international or regional organizations, the South African example is a little bit different because we don't have regional organizations as you had here. Unfortunately, the Arab League doesn't recognize Israel as one of its members, so we cannot refer to this organization as a regional one. I will go to the second question, and with regard to preconditions, as well asked by Mr. Dudley. As was made clear in my presentation and also by the Israeli politicians, we reject preconditions. We believe in the fact that everyone should sit to the table and negotiate without any preconditions. I would like also to make a remark that when we signed the Oslo Accords, both sides, the Palestinian and the Israeli, agreed that we are starting our negotiations without preconditions. It was already agreed by the two sides not to have preconditions. So here we have a situation that everything changes and suddenly preconditions are both being put on the table, even though both sides had agreed before that there should not be preconditions. With regard to the question of human rights, Israel respects human rights. We have our own committees. We are, with regard to Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons, let me just remind you that the full rights to have visits and so on. Just to remind you the case of Gilad Shalit, who was an Israeli prisoner on the other side for 5 years, not even one day he was able to see any representative of the Red Cross and so on. And also with regard to human rights and human rights organizations. Just to remind you that one of the personalities who was a member of one of the International Human Rights Council is Muammar Gaddafi. So I don't have to elaborate on that aspect as well. With regard to South Africa's opinion on the situation in Israel, there are many points that we are agreeing on the two-state solution, on the fact that the two sides have to solve the problem with a peaceful negotiation and so on. On other areas, we differ, but that's very legitimate. This is your side. You come, you bring it, we listen, we bring our side, and that's the way to deal with the conflict in the Middle East, and we do it in the South African way. With regards to the issue of land, we made it very clear that we are ready to give land for peace from the first day, and we have examples in the past. When we signed a peace agreement with Egypt, we gave Egypt
all its land till the last drop of land for peace. We are willing to negotiate land for peace with our other neighbors. We are ready to discuss it with the Palestinians as well. And this is the core of the issue. The problem basically in that area is a problem of land. But as you saw in that very short presentation that we gave you, there are security problems. It's a very narrow piece of land, a very small piece of land. And Israel is the only Jewish country in the world. If we don't take the right precautions, this would be our end. And let me just remind you what happened in 2005. In order to facilitate and help our neighbors to establish their own Palestinian state, we pulled out completely from Gaza. And that pull out was done by what was known at that time as a radical right-wing Israeli government. They pulled out Israeli forces from Gaza. What happened afterwards? Thousands of missiles from Gaza towards the southern part of Israel. So can you imagine if we reach a certain solution without taking care for our security needs, what will happen if you have a border 9 miles from the Mediterranean? What will happen to Israel at that time? With regard to the membership of the Palestinians in the UN, we would love to see Palestine as a member in the UN. But before you do it, you have to do it in the proper way. First of all, to try to get into terms with Israel, to reach an agreement, a peaceful agreement with us, so we can live peacefully next to each other. And then, definitely, without any problems, we'll be the first ones to support you as another member in the UN. But it has to be according as the two sides have agreed before. And with regard to Jerusalem, we made it very clear that everything is negotiable. The moment we sit down again onto the table, everything can be negotiated. And let me remind you that in 2000, when Arafat and Barak met in Camp David in the U.S., Jerusalem was brought by Israel as well. And Barak at that time was able and ready to make many concessions over Jerusalem. For the first time in our history, the response on the other side, on the Palestinian side, was very negative. So I will repeat again, everything is negotiable. But it has to be done in a dialogue and in a peaceful way, not in a war. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I will start with the first question about the regional organization. Indeed, we have the RFP, which is based in Cairo. Palestine has always a permanent seat. We coordinate with the Arab countries a lot of work, political, economical, and other on other levels too. And it's an important organization. And I don't think Israel is an Arab country. Therefore, they say it's a Jewish state, and I don't think they will be interested in joining the Arab League. We have other regional organizations, possibly not political, but we have some regional organizations which coordinate a lot of work, as I said, economical and otherwise. Secondly, in relation to a question which was raised by the Member of Parliament in relation to the Freedom Charter, we have in the PLO Charter, which we have announced and in 1964, on the basis of that, the PLO was created as an organization to represent the Palestinian people, political and other, in the world, and it has the recognition of the world. Although my good friend Naeem always is a bit critical of the PLO and say the PLO is not there, it's no more there. Yes, the PLO very much is still there, and it do represent the national interest of the Palestinian people. Yes, we need to strengthen this organization. We need to look at this organization, reform it and restructure it, and which is something natural and good and healthy for the Palestinian people. But it is there, and it is the organization which was created in order to represent the Palestinian people. Of course, Hamas is not a member of the PLO, and I hope Hamas will join the PLO, and I am sure that Hamas as an organization wanted to become a part of the PLO at a time which I think hopefully will be soon. Regarding human rights, of course, the Palestinians fully adhere to international law and legitimacy, and we indeed observe the human rights of the of others and our people. But the issue in the Middle East that our human rights are being violated every day by the state of Israel. The continued occupation and the denial of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination is a violation of the human rights of our people by Israel. And it's a problem. We are struggling in order to bring our people to become equal like anybody else in that region. And human rights is something essential we respect. I think whoever visited the Palestinian territory will see the transparency when it comes to justice, when it comes to laws, and the respect of the human rights among our own people. And I hope the delegation which is traveling as a vehicle soon to Palestine will make sure that human rights are being respected by the Palestinians. The question of issue of land, it is the issue of Palestine, and the land is the most sacred issue in somebody's life. The land is there, unfortunately, being abused by Israel, especially the Palestinian, being every day being confiscated, built on it illegal settlements, you know, and the denial of the Palestinian people their land. This is what makes the issue, the Palestinian issue, always at the heart of all the issues in the Middle East. Someone asked why did I say that joining the UN is good, something good for Israel, and I meant it because when we have the same status as the United Nations, that gives us an advantage and gives the Israelis also an advantage, so we can negotiate on equal footing. And that, in my view, will strengthen and consolidate a political settlement in the Middle East. And it's a legitimate and natural right for any nation to seek a recognition of the international community. And our presence at the UN, in my view, it means a recognition of the international community for the Palestinian rights to self-determination. And I think because of that, many countries have already supported the Palestinian bid. And I hope it will happen soon. When I spoke about religious claim, I meant Israel always says that this is their holy land. They have religious and historical places. It is their way from saying what they claim. Where Judaism as a religion was born. But also the Palestinians have the same claim. We have very important and historical religious sites in Palestine. Actually, the entire country is something which we all as Palestinians feel proud of. That it's something has always gave us the pride of being part of that part of the world. Jerusalem itself has a holy site for Muslims. Yes, it has holy sites for Christian Palestinians too. It's not only the Wailing Wall there, or King David Temple. So Palestinians, either Muslims or Christians, have also historical and religious sites in Palestine. So it is what I meant here, that we all have the right to live together in that part of the world and make good use of that great, beautiful piece of land. And it's not possible to be exclusively for one at the expense of the other. I don't know if I have answered all the questions or there's something else. Thank you.
I think we need to take some questions. There was a hand, the gentleman with the purple shirt. Take the third row, yes.
Thank you. This is Dr. Reichman. I want to respond to the South African Zionist Federation. One of the things you mentioned, that Israel is the only country where Christianity is increasing. That's not true. We need to acknowledge that there's 1.something of Russian Christians that moved to Israel in the 80s. There's more Christian Palestinians outside in the diaspora than in Palestine. There was in 48, there were 77 massacres. A few of them were in Christian, for Christian villages. So, and if you just take the natural growth, Israel is not the only country where Christian can increase. You can make any country increase if you want to host immigrants, providing them with houses and roads and so forth. So, the assumption or stating that Israel is the only country where Christianity increased has implied that either you being a stupid people or naive people, or you are naive. But because this is not true at all, it has no ground. the other thing is about the historical existence of the Israel or Judaism or Jews in Palestine. The historic document said that Jews were in Masada and in one quarter in Jerusalem. They have their own cemeteries. They have their own houses. They are not allowed to bury their bodies everywhere. So Jerusalem was not like, and the documents are available at the Palestine National Archive, at the Ottoman National Archive in Istanbul. So for the last 1400 years, Jews didn't exist in Jerusalem other than their quarter. And the documents are available. Now before that, there's another story. That story, there was a span of time where the Jews established their kingdom on Masada. And then, Masada is a small part of Palestine, which is south of the Dead Sea. And there where the massacre happened for them, where they throw themselves outside because of the attack they had. I mean, to claim that all Palestine is a historic place for Jews is also a myth. It's a massive myth.
Thank you. I'm Terry Crawford Brown. I'm the organizing secretary for the Brussels Tribunal on Palestine, which is in which you'll be aware I met here at the District 6 Museum 10 days ago. The Russell Tribunal on Palestine was established in 2009 after Operation Cast Lead, when Israel attacked the Gaza Strip. And it was chaired by a German-born Jew, Stefan Hessel, who said Nazi Germany during the 1930s, was imprisoned in Buchenwald during World War II, escaped execution, but then became one of the drafters of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. In 1948. He is the chair of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine and was appalled by the bombardment by Israel of the Gaza Strip, hence the Russell Tribunal on Palestine. And the first hearings were held in Barcelona in March last year, March 2010, when the Russell Tribunal considered the complicity of the European Union and its member states in not holding Israel accountable to the United Nations Charter, to the Geneva Conventions, and other instruments of international law. The second session was held in London in November 2010, when the tribunal considered the complicity of international corporations in profiteering from the occupation of Palestine. It was rooted in the opinion of the International Criminal Court of Justice opinion of 2004 that found the apartheid wall is illegal, should be dismantled, and the Palestinians should be compensated for their losses, and that everything following the occupation of Palestine was illegal and should be discontinued. So there is massive profiteering, and what has become apparent is that although the Israeli government talks peace, in fact it has no intention of negotiating a peace, Israel, there is massive war profiteering, and of course it all comes under the cloud of national security. So in the meantime, there's talk of peace, but huge profiteering of both Israeli and international corporations. The third session here in Cape Town was to look at the International Convention Against Apartheid, and whether Israel's treatment of Palestinians, both within Israel itself and in the West Bank, violates the International Convention on Apartheid. And we called over 20 witnesses. The Israeli government was invited to participate, but declined to do so. The tribunal is not a trial. It is more in the fashion of an American grand jury of collecting evidence. So the purpose of these tribunals and sessions is to gather evidence. It is not a trial, contrary to some of the misconceptions deliberately purveyed by some of the critics. It is to gather information. But the findings of the session in Cape Town were overwhelmingly that Israel is in violation of the international crime against international convention against apartheid, which is a crime against humanity internationally. The fourth session will be in New York, and I will give the committee the documents and the findings of the session here in Cape Town. The fourth session will be in New York next year, and it will consider the complicity of the United States and the United Nations in not holding Israel accountable to the numerous decisions and resolutions of the United Nations, including, for instance, the right for refugees. So given that the involvement of South Africa in these issues, I would hope that the committee will take this into account. Thank you very much.
Shall we go? Honorable Chief, I need some guidance from you at this time.
Yes. Can I just make this point? Please. The honorable members will have to come in.
Can I just request? We would really love to hear everybody. But there is a house sitting, as I indicated, that we have questions. Now, the request, therefore, is for us to be able to hear everybody. We need to bring it quickly, to the point.
Just
about that. Because already it's 25 minutes. I don't want to waste another
second. A few more, just short comments or questions.
Thank you, Aldi. Specific. I think. My name is Ikiwe Tlusam from the Palestinian Solidarity Organization called PSA. One is that we have submitted the Gaza document into the government. We need a response on that one also to look at as you are going to discuss the issues in terms of the report that is contributing the Gaza document. The other point that I wanted to say that it's a question that as South Africans, we are not only intervention in this situation, but we are also looking our moral values. We are looking at the democratic values and the human rights, and our program in terms of unification, where there is a destabilization of fights in different countries. So when we take decision, it must also be in mind. You know, to those are the South African processes that are taking place. One is the question that the occupation of Palestinian territory in West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza, and also the violation of basic human rights by the Israel government on the education, housing and BRICS and the economy, a number of issues that they are happening there. We needed that to say that it must be declared as a crime against humanity. You must take the position, I'm just pleading that you must take a position that say that it's a violation of the also a violation of the international law. The other point that we needed also to raise as a PSA is the question that of the companies that are in South Africa that continue to support the program of Israel, even when they violated the human rights and all those kind of things. A position that, because we're having companies that are also building that wall, we're having companies that are contributing on the razor wires and all those kind of things that are here in South Africa, and they are doing damage in Israel. We must take a position in that, say that, what are we doing in those companies and all those kind of things, because they're continuing to contribute on the genocide that is being continued. The last point that I wanted to raise is the question of the people that are serving in the army of Israel. Serving in the army that is destroying the human rights values of other people and come here in South Africa and serve within the army of South Africa and the security establishment such as the SAPs. So we need also to say that what are we doing about that kind of a thing? Because it's a crime. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. I don't want to act here as a vice chair. I'm not. I don't want to second guess what you're doing. But please, ladies and gentlemen, all these things are important. Thank you so much. But we simply do not have the time. So you'll end up with the honorable members here not having a head, at least most of you, because they have to rush. So please, just, Mr. Facilitator, please don't allow anybody to speak for more than one. So be restricted.
Very good. Honorable members, my input will be very quick. It will come in the form of a question. I would like to pose the question, if there is time for an engineer to perhaps answer the question as to what implications would it have if our South African state organs adopt a policy in favor of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Now, I'll tell you why a BDS campaign is important for the parliamentarians sitting here to consider. It is because, as our own anti-apartheid struggle has demonstrated, this is an effective, non-violent form of resistance that can bring an end to injustice and contribute immensely to liberation. This is, in fact, no distortion of history.
Hi. Thank you for giving me the floor. I would like to ask a question to the Israeli ambassador. We talked a lot about the expansion into the West Bank and the continued construction of a settlement. I would like to know why this hasn't stopped, if it seems so wrong and so illegal. And I'd like to this phrase, and if security is such an issue, why are you building more houses and more homes in a certain area that you deem so unsafe and so hostile? That seems counterintuitive for a security policy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Adel Abdullah. I am one of the Egyptian community living in South Africa. My question to Mr. Israeli Ambassador, you have mentioned that 57,000 Israeli or Jewish and were driven out of their homes and given them the right to come back and form the Zionist groups and to attack the Palestinians in their own land. Doesn't the same right apply to 4 to 5 million Palestinians driven out of their land and being refugees all over the world? And the second point, and it's very important to mention here, what happened today, taking double of your time, I'm sorry to mention this, but taking double of your time is this attitude here in South Africa. How about your dealing with the Palestinians on land in Palestine? And also, the daily attacks on the Palestinians, isn't recognized by you? Isn't it regarded by you? I hope the future is getting a better situation for the Palestinians as well. Thank you.
Thank you, honorable members, for giving me this opportunity.
I will be very brief. Firstly, is that, you know, there was a clip that was shown earlier that showed the demographics in Palestine now, where the population was 75% Jewish and 20% were Muslim. That is current. I want us to take cognizance of what was the demographics in the 1900s, where the population at that time was 90% Muslim and 10% Jewish. And we've got to start formulating some kind of strategy as how this transformed over this period of time. Where are those people? And how did this transformation take place? That's the first point. The second point is just a question in terms of how much percentage of Israeli land is occupied by Palestinians. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Zubaba. I've just got a brief couple of comments. Firstly, the Rational Tribunal, as a person who studied law, I found it quite interesting that it paraded literally, let's say, a dozen people sharing the same views. My honest desire was to hear a balanced debate, because I came here looking for honest debate between two parties so that one can say, this is correct, this is incorrect, and form a view. Unfortunately, it didn't do that. I went there, wouldn't even allow me entry, but there was no fair debate. I'll leave it at that. I think the issue for me is, I've heard a lot of people claiming that the South African population stands by this and that and that and that, and there isn't much facts to substantiate it except for emotion of somebody saying this is what people believe in. What I would love to see is a robust debate with both sides, and both, you know, if you're giving me a piece of evidence, surely somebody must be doing something right and somebody must be wrong. An accurate portrayal of both sides. There's a lot of one-sided portrayal, a lot of emotion, and it allows people then to be swept into one particular direction. But I think what we really need is a balanced view. When somebody does something right, applaud them. If they're wrong, tell them. But I think if you say the sins of so-and-so are 10 and the sins of one are one, you know, anybody can see that is not balanced. I'm really pleading just for that balance. I think what we pride ourselves in as a country is constructive engagement. I mean, whether you look at our neighbors in Zimbabwe, you'll see that we engage with them, with Sudan, whatever country. And I think what we need is that engagement with both parties, not selective engagement. Thank you.
I would just say it is not enough time for Israelis, what's happening around the world, to sit early on the table before the time is out, before the time is in. Because as long you sit, as earlier you sit, is better. Because injustice is created, is citizen. And after that, you blame the people for answering. And at the same point, you create. So what is happening around the world, we must focus in it. Because the millions was in the Tahrir of Egypt. They will never forget Palestine.
Al-Mujib, I think we have satisfied.
Yeah.
No. There's two more hands.
Debate has been interesting and fascinating. My name's Alan Tusher, and I've heard a lot of claims and counterclaims that have been expressed here today by both sides, and it's difficult, I'm sure, for the honourable members to reach a conclusion listening to information from both sides and, as I say, claims and counterclaims. But I think what we did learn from the South African experience, even though Mr. Jinnah wouldn't like to compare necessarily the two experiences and say that they're exactly alike, and maybe they're not, but what we certainly learned from the South African experience, which I think is very instructive for all of us here today, which I think can be very helpful in the deliberations going forward, is that South Africans decided to put their differences aside, not to forget necessarily, but to put their differences aside, to come together to work out a solution that was equitable and fair to all. And my plea here today is that we should try and not so much hold on to the past, but look to the future, because that's where we need to go. And I think South Africa can certainly be instructive in helping both sides to achieve a future which is two states living together, side by side, in security, and in peace. And I think that is really the vision that we should work towards, that we should all strive towards, that we should all commit towards, because everybody can have grievances and everybody can talk about, you know, what was wrong and what was right from each person's perspective. But at the end of the day, we need to come together as human beings, forge a peace between us, and go forward and learn to live with one another. And I hope that the members over here will take that spirit forward when they examine this issue. Thank you.
Good day, my name is Carmen Smith. I would say just one issue. The UN process, if you look at the situation with Palestine and Israel, it's going nowhere. If you look at the situation with Morocco and Western Sahara, it's also in a similar situation that it's checkmate. Now, if you look at our negotiations, because everybody's talking about this negotiations of ours and making a comparative analysis. But our negotiations were internally driven. The situation with the Palestinian-Israel situation is that the mediator is biased to one group. And maybe the solution cannot be through the mediation of the U.S. I would take it. Maybe there should be another way of looking at this thing and trying to find a solution from the two nations themselves without our personal solution.
Okay, thank you. I would just plead perhaps that the facilitator, that the two ambassadors be given the last 2 minutes each, just to give them some of the issues. They won't finish all of them, but that we perhaps finish off with some of the issues.
Can I leave it?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, distinguished ladies and gentlemen. This morning it was indeed a very interesting one. On a personal level, I think it was very informative discussion. Some of us deal with the Palestinian-Israeli situation on a daily basis because this is what we, at least what I do myself in this country. But I think I have benefited a lot from the contributions made by everybody. We as Palestinians have made it clear on different occasions and platforms that we are for a justice, we are for a political settlement based on United Nations resolutions. We have accepted the concept of two-state solution, and we think it is fair for everybody. It's fair for the Palestinians, it's fair for the Israelis. The question of continuing to occupy the Palestinian land and building settlements, something which, in my view, is going to cause problems, because it's not possible to build a state, a viable independent state, while the Israeli government continue to build settlements. It's not possible that Palestinians build their own independent sovereign state on the Palestinian land when Israel continues to confiscate and build these settlements. A future settlement should be based on United Nations resolution. We have said it, and I would like to repeat it all the time. We have already accepted Israel as a state within 1967 borders. It's the time for Israel to come publicly and announce that Palestine is a state, and it has to be a state on the West Bank, Gaza, with East Jerusalem as its capital. This is the only way out in order to put an end to this conflict. The security of Israel can be only achieved when the Palestinians have their own country back and have their own independence state. Yes, indeed, South Africa is a model which we feel proud of it, and we learn a lot from your experience, and we have learned in the past, and we have lived your own experience. Possibly our situation is a little bit different. Indeed, South Africa has a role to play in supporting us and supporting peace in the Middle East. And this is what South Africa is doing today. And we will always urge South Africa to continue on its own role to bring a permanent peace into the Middle East. And therefore, once again, I would like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for giving us this opportunity. It's indeed very important to engage each other on issues of mature concern. The Middle East is an important issue, and it will affect always the entire security of the world. And thank you very much.
Dear Chairperson, dear guests and friends, what we saw today was the South African spirit at its best today. I sat here with my Palestinian colleague, with other friends and South African fellows. We are listening to what they have to say. They are listening to what we are saying, and that's the way. What happened this morning was an example for it. And therefore, I would like to thank you for organizing that event where each side was able to express its positions. We understand your suffering, Ali, very well, because we as people, we suffered very similar suffering in the past. We aspired for many years to get back to our homeland, and we achieved it. And we would like also to see you achieving your goals and establishing your own Palestinian state, living next to us in peace. And this is our goal and your goal, and which we have to achieve it together, because there is no other way, and most of us, we know it. Those who suffer from wars know it more than anyone else. We have to look forward, not backward, because complaining and then trying to get explanations and so on, it will lead us nowhere. And therefore, I'm calling again for your side to return back to the table, and together we can solve, I'm absolutely sure, we can solve all the problems that we exist there. It will take a long time, a short time, but there is a hope for both of us to live in that very narrow piece of land together in peaceful coexistence. Thank you.
The final word goes to Ambassador Mark on the request of the Honourable Chair.
Thank you, Facilitator. As somebody who's been dealing with this issue for the last 12 years, I served in Israel as ambassador before becoming head of the Middle East Division. I always feel that the more I know and more I deal with this issue, the less I know. It really is a very complicated issue. Both sides, I think, have made points which we all need to reflect on. But I think by engaging with each other, by talking instead of shouting at each other, we can move this process forward to a satisfactory conclusion. Thank you very much, Chair. Honourable Chair.
What we would like to see.
Palestine and Israel to make. This engagement that we've had as all of us sitting in one room and talking about how to move forward. And I think at one point I said to the chairperson, let's step in this. We lock them into one room and you don't come out until you resolve the matter. At Shop 17 in Johannesburg, you don't want to go there. So I think, chairperson, I think on behalf of the committee and all of us, we'd just like to thank everybody that participated this morning, all the presenters. Some of you we've seen before, as I said. And let's continue discussion. And I'm also glad that we had both ambassadors in one room today here, because we have been struggling to get everybody together. And I think let this be an example of how we would like to see your situation resolved. In an amicable manner, everybody putting everything on the table. It might be painful at some point. That's how our negotiations were. Some points were very painful, but we got through it. And we do believe that we can as well. So, Chairperson, on behalf of the committee yourself, thank you very much to everyone.
Thank you very much, Honorable Jacobus. Just allow me to make two announcements. All of you are invited for lunch. You'll be directed by West Baban, the dining hall is across. But please follow him. The man with the white and beige jacket. That's one. He'll take you away. I'm not sure if the honourable members, but those of us who can, please do so. Excellency ambassadors, please, you are welcome to join us as well. Last announcement. The committee will be convening next week, because of the time constraints now, to reflect through all the briefing that we have on this matter, and we will then chart the way forward as a committee in terms of where we want to take this entire debate. In fact, we might very well decide we even want some more information on certain aspects. But as you know, parliamentary committee meetings are open to the public, so all of you are welcome to attend those committees. No protest there, too. But thank you very much.
Devices and the tables and stuff.
No, that's PMG. There were different devices and different people.
So what's the
especially after what happened at the UN.
Thank you. Welcome in Israel.
Can we quickly get lunch here?
Yeah.